Hello and welcome back to the God Story Podcast. I'm Brent Siddle, and this time I'm joined once again by Jennifer Holberg to talk about another great Christian poet. This is an occasional series on great Christian poets, or probably great poets, really. And this time we're going to talk about Christina Rossetti. Now, Jennifer is Professor and Chair of the English Department at Calvin University in the States and co-director of the Calvin Center for Faith and Writing. And if you remember, she's also the author of the book Nourishing Narratives, and we talked to her about Nourishing Narratives a few weeks ago, probably months ago now. Jennifer, hi, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Brent. So excited to chat with you again. This has become such a fun highlight of my life to get to talk with you. Thank you, listeners, for putting up with me once again.
Oh, no one's putting up with you. No, these have been fascinating discussions. I'm very grateful, just grateful that you give us the time, really. Now, who is Christina Rossetti, and why is she so important?
Yeah, well, so as we were talking earlier about the book, she's someone who I kind of come back to again and again. She's a 19th century poet, born in 1830. She's the youngest of four children. Some people will be familiar with the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, which was an artistic movement in Britain in the sort of the mid-19th century and into the later bit. And her brother, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, is one of the founders of that. And she's on the outer edge of that as a sister, not a brother, but a really important and interesting poet recognized in her time. But I think is someone that was very serious about her faith in both her life and her work. And I think she was somebody throughout her life who found it, I don't want to say difficult, but there was difficulty in trying to maintain both her poetic ambition and her Christian faith. And that comes up in a lot of her poems, even as scholars have sort of struggled with that bit of her, right? So she's always been an acknowledged poet, but I think people have liked some bits of her and struggled with some of the faith stuff. So that's why when we were talking about Hopkins was very influenced by her. In fact, he kind of acknowledged her as a foremother of his, and they met. And so I thought it'd be fun to talk about her with you today. Yeah.
Yeah. How does she differ from Hopkins?
Well, for one thing, I mean, they both share that kind of high Anglican upbringing. And Rossetti, throughout her life, is a very devoted tractarian, as they would have called it in the 19th century, right? Is very interested, even to the point of her sister becomes an Anglican nun. Rossetti herself doesn't go quite that far. She's always much more interested in being a lay person. So Hopkins, of course, goes all the way into the priesthood and, of course, converts to Catholicism. For Rossetti, Anglicanism is very important to her. And so she never quite goes over to Rome. But like him, I would say he's much more, we talked last time, I think, about how he's a lot more akin to jazz. He's a lot more, I think, formally experimental. I think she's more experimental in the kinds of topics she thinks about or the kinds of ways in which she tries to push at the difficulties of faith and she's a very theological poet. So I think they share some things in common. They're both, I think they both would have been, had we been able to meet them, I think they were both kind of intense personalities, as you know, as a lot of creative people are. Rossetti's father had a joke about his four children. He said he had two storms and two calms. And the two storms were Dante Gabriel and Christina, who were very stormy, very passionate. But like Hopkins, Rossetti really worried a lot about how to live, how to subdue that passion. So a lot of critics, especially the ones who can't quite figure out how to deal with her faith, talk a lot about her as a poet of renunciation, because in her life, she ends up turning down both of the men who proposed to her. One, because he had been a Catholic, become an Anglican, they got engaged, he became a Catholic again, and she said, no, I can't theologically go there. And then the other one, who she remained friends with her whole life and was clearly quite in love with, he was very sort of tepid in his faith, and she just could not ever, you know, they only remain friends. But she's very passionate, very, you know, could be probably extreme, but also I think she had a great sense of humor that comes out in her poetry maybe more than in Hopkins. And she has a kind of a self-awareness about herself too, I think.
You mentioned a very artistic family and a very artistic upbringing. Who and what were her major influences?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's some interesting work. I would, if people become interested in Rossetti, I would say one of the critics I most admire who works on Rossetti and has published on her is a woman named Dinah Rowe. She did both a group biography of the Rossettis called Rossettis in Wonderland. And she starts, her starting point is this picture that Lewis Carroll came and took of all the Rossetti siblings. But I would say her father was an exile from Italy. So in that time of turmoil politically in Italy, he leaves Italy as an adult and comes to England, where he's basically a professor and a translator. And I think for their family, Dante is one of the most probably important. Her sister wrote a biography. Dante Gabriel actually changed his name. He was originally Gabriel Dante. And Christina herself writes on Dante. So I would say Dante is a huge influence because of their father, and just sort of in, they all spoke Italian. And I would say the authorized version of the Bible, very important. And in fact, I was just looking at, in preparation for this, the ways in which Rossetti's work is so embedded with scripture and with the liturgy and with the Book of Common Prayer and all of that, that often I think people who are secular critics have a little more difficulty with her because they're just not picking up on it. And even we in our time are not as embedded in scripture, perhaps miss that as well. So I would say Dante and the Bible are really kind of her big things. Then she really read widely. She was educated. Her mother and her mother's sisters were all teachers and governessed and had schools. And so they read really, really widely in the classics. She could read lots and lots of languages. So she had a real classical kind of upbringing. Fun fact, this is, if you're ever on Jeopardy or whatever your equivalent is in New Zealand, her mother was a Polidori. And if you know anything about the Romantics, John Polidori was Byron's doctor for a time. And when they all went off to Switzerland and they had that haunted summer, right, where they made a bet with each other about who could write the best ghost story. And Byron and Percy Shelley don't actually come up with anything. But that's when Mary Shelley writes Frankenstein and John Polidori writes a thing called The Vampire. And so he's an interesting character, too, although kind of sad. He ends up dying. He takes his own life in his 20s. But that's her uncle. So lots of literary, and it seems like a family that had a lot going on all the time.
Yeah. So could you describe Christina as a romantic poet?
I think there are certainly elements of her. Her most famous poem, Goblet Market, that we might have time for today, is sometimes described as Keatsian because of its descriptions. I don't think she's romantic in some of the ways that, say, Wordsworth or Coleridge was. I do think she has some of that sensuality of language, even though she's a quite simple poet. People often compare her to Emily Dickinson, and Dickinson was very influenced by Rossetti. So I would say yes and no, but she's definitely has a lot of the Pre-Raphaelite kind of ideas about kind of returning to a kind of artistic sensibility before the Reformation, that kind of Anglo-Catholicism that obviously was her faith tradition.
Yes, well, we're going to come on and look at some of the poetry in a moment, but I wonder at what point did she start writing poetry and what sort of poetry did she write?
Yeah, she started really young. They all wrote and did things like that. And in fact, her grandfather had a kind of printing press. And so her first little book came out when she was 16, privately printed by her granddad, and was writing pretty actively all through her childhood and young adult. And in fact, some of her more famous poems, the ones that are more about romance and renunciation and some of that, are all kind of early in her life before she was 35. She lives until the 1890s. So that last half, where she gets increasingly religious, writes almost exclusively religious verse, and also quite a few devotionals. And she writes a whole book on the Book of Revelation. I know we are not on video, I know. But this is how big, like, she wrote a lot. And that's one of the problems is, you know, I think this is 1,200 pages, which is the Penguin edition of her stuff. So very prolific.
I must get that Penguin edition. It'll be fascinating to read a stuff on Revelation. How does Rossetti challenge Victorian gender expectations, though? Because this is something you wanted to talk about, I know.
Yeah. Well, and I think she's interesting because, you know, she herself struggled a little bit with where she was politically. So there's a letter that critics often talk about where she doesn't want to sign a letter in support of suffrage. And in the same letter, though, she says she thinks women should be MPs. And there's a lot of interesting work, especially recently. And again, I'll shout out Dinah Rowe on this, where she talks about how she thinks that her kind of Christian feminism gives her ways to critique things. So I'll talk about one poem. So as I said, she was associated with the Pre-Raphaelites. She was one of their first models. And so she's around all these men. But she also has this really interesting poem that was actually never published in her lifetime, I think out of respect for her brother. But she was very critical of the way in which they tended to kind of replicate a certain kind of woman. And if you're familiar with the Pre-Raphaelites, you know, they have kind of a look. But she supposedly, and I want to be clear, I always know that we're not saying every poem is biographical or the poet is the actual speaker. But I think this is a really interesting poem. It's a sonnet. I'll just read it really quickly. It's called In an Artist's Studio. And it's literally based on her visit to her brother's studio. One face looks out from all his canvases. One self-same figure walks or stands. One self-same figure sits or walks or leans. We found her hidden just behind those screens. That mirror gave back all her loveliness. A queen in opal or in ruby dress. A nameless girl in freshest summer greens. A saint, an angel. Every canvas means the same one thing, neither more nor less. And this is the key line here. And I just want to remember that, you know, the vampire connection. He feeds upon her face by day and night. And she with kind, true eyes looks back on him, fair as the moon and joyful as the light. Not wan with waiting nor with sorrow dim, not as she is, but was when hope shone bright. Not as she is, but as she fills his dream. And I think it's really interesting in that poem where it's talking about, even though he's painting her in all these different modes, it's always in this kind of male constructed way, and it's not based in reality. And so I would say this poem, I think, is an interesting key to the way that Rossetti wants to kind of discuss the range of female experience, and not as you feel the male gaze or the idea of the female standard of beauty that the Pre-Raphaelites held, but, you know, and not sort of feeding this sort of really unfortunate sort of succubus kind of image of he's feeding on her in ways that are not healthy. And I think that Rossetti's poetry itself is trying to say women can have a range of emotions, even the kind of unpleasant ones, or the ones where she seems cold, she seems unloving. She wrote poems for children, and yet she wasn't particularly a baby person, right? And so all of those ways in which Victorian women were supposed to be charming and soft and believe, but without doubt. And she's very much a doubty poet. And that's another way where she and Hopkins, I think, have some interesting intersections. So that would just be a few ways. And I just think that's a cool poem, too. You know,
the male artist is vampire. I mean, it's certainly an unusual image. One I don't think I've encountered in the Romantics. That I can remember. Anyway, and I've read a lot of romantic poetry. going back to my university years anyway, all that Wordsworth, my goodness me. Now, in what way? Yeah, he does go on.
Rossetti, and especially if you don't like poetry that much, Rossetti's great because a lot of her poems are really short. Like that one was just a sonnet. Yes. She has a lot of lyrics. So,
I mean, I have to say, I absolutely adored Wordsworth as a boy. I loved all the nature, but once he gets into going out on the boat on the lake, and it just goes on and on and on, and I think, well, goodness gracious me. Anyway, now, in what ways is Rossetti psychologically astute, though?
Yeah, well, so I think it's interesting. I'm going to read another one that I think is kind of interesting, because my students and I always debate what this one is about. But in some ways, I'll just do a spoiler alert and say it doesn't, I think, actually matter what the actual thing is. But it's called A Pause of Thought. And it's this idea of the ways in which, as I talked about earlier, I think she's a very ambitious person. She wanted to be a poet. She thought of herself as having a career. But she and also, but like, what does that mean in terms of having a relationship and pursuing a godly life and all the things we pursue? And it might even sound a little Pauline. Anyway, I'll read it. A pause of thought. I looked for that which is not, nor can be. So that's where we pause, and my students, we try to guess what it is. But here we get a little shout out if we know our scripture, and hope deferred made my heart sick in truth, right? So Proverbs, a hope deferred, but years must pass before a hope of youth is resigned utterly. In other words, even as we know we should give something up, it takes years for us to give something up that we've wanted and wanted and wanted and wanted. I watched and waited with a steadfast will, and though the object seemed to flee away that I so longed for ever day by day, I watched and waited still. Sometimes I said, this thing shall be no more. My expectation wearies and shall cease. I will resign it now and be at peace. Yet never gave it o'er. And I just love the internal dialogue. And Rossetti has a lot of poems where she talks to herself, and herself knows the answer, and she can't go with it though. Or she has some great poems where she talks to God too, and she says, Jesus is like, good job, you've been doing a good job, Christine. And she's like, no, I haven't. And Christ is like, yeah, you have. And she's like, but I haven't. And at the end of the poem, the best she can do in that poem is say, eh, I won't give up. But anyway, yet I never gave it o'er. Sometimes I said, just to finish this one, it is an empty name I long for. So an empty name, that could be the name of a spouse, right? I was going to marry and have another name, or I wanted to be a famous poet, or because I wanted to be a name, right? But I love how Rossetti always has all these layers that it could be. It is an empty name I long for. To a name, why should I give the peace of all the days I have to live? Yet, gave it all the same. Alas, and so now she talks to herself again. Alas, thou foolish one, alike unfit for healthy joy or salutary pain. Right? You're always in this messy muddle. You're never fully joyful, and you're never like feeling the pain of loss because you're always in this yearning place, and you know you can't, but you're so wound up you can't get out of it. So the last two lines are, thou knowest the chase useless, and again turns to follow it. And I just think that's so much about life, right? And the unhappiness people have in life is there's this thing they want. They know they shouldn't want it, and they can't give it up, and they sort of stay in this thing. And so this poem, a little pause of thought, I had this moment when I realized, and yet I love that she doesn't resolve it. It doesn't have this kind of triumphant Jesus-y ending. This says, and then I learned and now I'm better. It's like, yep, the struggle continues, right?
Yes, it reminded me very much of Browning's, what I always think of as Browning's sort of psychological monologues, where he has these characters in speaking and thinking, and they're quite fragmented in some ways, those poems too. A
Those
couple
thematic
of,
monologues, exactly. Yeah.
a fascinating poet, Browning. This is Robert, of course. Let's not forget there is another Browning,
That's right.
to be
And
fair. Yes.
what's interesting is in the 19th century, they started being seen, both Elizabeth Barrett Browning and Rossetti, as sort of rivals. And after Elizabeth Barrett Browning died in the 1860s, Rossetti was sort of seen as her natural successor, and Robert Browning was a little bit protective of her, and I think Rossetti never wanted to sort of be competitive with her. She liked her. But yeah, they were very much talked about in the same kinds of circles, wrote a lot of sonnets. And in fact, Rossetti writes a sonnet sequence that's much darker than the sonnets from the Portuguese, although that also, I would say, has its darkness. But anyway, that's kind of an answer to they're in dialogue. So yeah,
Oh, fascinating. Yeah.
they all know
Now,
each other, you know.
two of the poems that you sent me fascinated me. A Better
Yeah.
Resurrection and Good Friday. Now, these I thought were really quite amazing. Now, how does Rossetti as a Christian write about her feelings of disconnectedness and distance
Yeah.
in these poems?
Yeah, I really like these two poems because I think that as people who, if you've grown up in the faith, If you've been a believer for a long time, I don't think there's not a lot of poems, especially for the 19th century, that sort of do this. I mean, there's Tennyson and In Memoriam and stuff, but she writes a lot about this. She has a lot of poems like these, and these are some of my favorites. And so one of them, the Good Friday poem, she kind of imagines herself. And why isn't she feeling anything about the resurrection and about the death of Christ? So, what we can maybe just walk through it again. It's a very short little
Yes,
poem.
please.
Am I a stone and not a sheep? I love that first image, that sense of just like, man, yeah. Am I a stone and not a sheep that I can stand, O Christ, beneath thy cross to number drop by drop thy blood's slow loss and yet not weep? In other words, I can literally imagine it and I feel nothing. Am I a stone and not a sheep? Not so those women loved who with exceeding grief lamented thee. So the women at the cross, they felt it. Not so fallen Peter weeping bitterly. Not so the thief was moved. Not so the sun and moon, which hid their faces in a starless sky, a horror of great darkness at broad noon. So everybody in the scene except for her, and I'm reminded of some of those Italian paintings, from the Middle Ages or the Renaissance, where there's the scene and then like the random saint is also there. There's a lot of those in San Marco where Saint Dominic keeps popping up. But Rossetti here is not participating in the worship. She feels distant from it, even as all these other people respond appropriately. So she says, a horror of great darkness at broad noon, I only I. But then the poem ends with this very interesting four lines. Yet give not o'er. In other words, don't give up on me. Don't give up on me, but seek thy sheep. True shepherd of the flock. So, no matter how I'm feeling, I don't know if I'm a sheep or if I'm a stone, but you're the shepherd. And so, seek me. Greater than Moses, speaking to Jesus, right? Turn and look once more and smite a rock. And she has this wonderful thing at the end where it kind of twists around and she's both sheep and stone. And Jesus, the great shepherd, comes and rescues her. But like Moses in the wilderness to get the water out of the rock. And it may involve something painful as she's returning to Christ, but also Christ, you can do all of the work. I think it's very clever. What did you think of it?
Oh, I loved it. I
Yeah.
absolutely loved it. And I was greatly intrigued by a better resurrection as well.
Yeah. And so in that one, she says she starts it off again with this sort of numbness. In fact, she uses that word. I have no wit, no words, no tears. And I love, of course, when poets do this, right? I don't have words, and yet I'm going to write you a poem. But okay. My heart within me, like a stone, which picks up on the other one, is numbed too much for hopes or fears. So back to that kind of paralysis of the earlier poems. Look right, look left. I dwell alone. I lift mine eyes, but dimmed with grief, no everlasting hills I see. My life is in the falling leaf. Oh, Jesus, quicken me. And lots of interesting poems like Donne and Herbert. And then she picks up this idea in the next stanza. My life is like a faded leaf, my harvest dwindled to a husk. Truly, my life is void and brief and tedious in the barren dusk. My life is like a frozen thing, no bud nor greenness can I see. Yet rise it shall, the sap of spring. O Jesus, rise in me. Again, that sense of that quickening. Hopkins also has a poem about, rise in me, the sap. And then finally, my life is like a broken bowl that cannot hold one drop of water for my soul or cordial in the searching cold. Cast in the, so the now her, this is the solution. Cast in the fire, the perished thing. Melt and remold it till it be a royal cup for him, my king. Oh, Jesus, drink of me. And so I love those two first stanzas are, bring me back, continue to rise, but then also use me in your service, and become this kind of a means of grace to other people. I mean, I think it's kind of a Eucharistic image there at the end, the cup that Jesus remolds, and then we become his cutlery, as it were, which I think is a lovely sort of gendered again back to your original question a couple of minutes ago, like this idea of what being the cup to hold this thing for other people. Because Rossetti does have this kind of outward focus of her life. I think it's important. I know we're in just our last couple of minutes. As always, just time flies with you. I just love talking to you so much. But she did a very interesting thing. So as I said, her sister became an Anglican nun, but she herself worked for a number of years in basically a women's shelter. And so she had a lot of a one-on-one work where she went every week. And worked, consistent hours with so-called, in the Victorian period, the called fallen women. But a lot of her poetry then is around the ways in which we need to actually be restoring not just middle class, good spinsters like her, who she's also trying to show are not really the good spinsters, right? They're women who are also having profound doubt and sin and all of this, but also how do we move together then to reclaim the lost and to be a means of grace to other people? So,
We have a few minutes yet. Goblin Market. We must deal with Goblin Market. Probably a
yeah.
most, m probably a most famous poem, a rather unusual poem too. How does Rossetti think about sin in Goblin
Yeah.
Market?
Well, yeah, and obviously it's the most written about, and if you are going to start with Rossetti, I recommend it. It's really fun. It's got lots and lots of fruit, but it's unseasonable fruit. And I think it's interesting. There's just a couple of things I'll mention as kind of a teaser for people to read it. So it's about two sisters. It's a little bit like, I don't know, you guys have Charlie Brown
Oh,
in
yes.
museums,
Oh, for sure.
right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I know he's kind of a global phenomenon, but you know how in Charlie Brown there's no parents? So they're these two young girls, ages a little bit undefined, but there's no parents. And they go to get their water every night. And when they go out to get the water, they're these goblin men and they're on this liminal space, right? They're outside of town. And there's an important line in the poem where Rossetti says, when it's talking about these merchant goblin men, they're a brotherhood together, they're in it together. But men sell not such in any town. So there's clearly some good men too. But it's a little allegory. It's a little, I don't know, people debate if it's an allegory. It's this little story about these two sisters who hear the call of the goblin men. And one leaves the other, which is important, right? And I always talk to my students about what do we know about going out with our friends? We don't leave them. But it's also about virtue. So is virtue just covering your ears and running away, or is it actually facing it? But I think when they think about sin, which was your original question, one thing that happens is when the one sister eats the fruit, so she does, in fact, stay behind and engage the goblins and eats their fruit, it is enjoyable. And I think if this is a poem, I think on one level it is about sexual fall. I don't think that's the only way it needs to be read, but one of the women who has eaten the fruit before has died and her grave is blighted. And there's all these things about kind of traditional things that are thought of women who fall sexually, quote unquote, in the Victorian period. But the poem and so much Victorian literature, in Dickens, if you're the fallen woman, you die or you move to New Zealand or Australia or something or America, but you don't get to marry. You don't get re-brought into the thing. You're just sort of done. And Rossetti wants to see a different way. But first of all, she says people sin because the fruit is delicious. And I think that is unusual. When I talk to my own students about their kind of the sex ed they get, it never sounds like it's fun. And like that's the first, right? The fruit is delicious. And Rossetti's pretty clear about that. People eat the fruit because they enjoy the fruit. Okay. But then what happens is the goblin men don't want to sell to her anymore and the young woman can't hear it. And so as she begins to, fade, her sister has to decide, do I let her just die, like this other friend of ours that just died, or do I go and face them? And so she goes out and actually faces these men who have the kind of attitudes that she calls out in the first poem that we looked at. This thing that women are only reduced to their sexuality, to their body parts, right? You can buy the fruit with your hair, right? And she endures what is a very much an assault of these goblin men. And it's very much, if you read it, it very much is, it calls up all the kind of the way in which Christ was tortured and mocked and spat upon. But she brings this fruit home and she redeems it. She redeemes the sin. And there's a Eucharistic moment where she says to the sister, "Eat me, drink me, love me." Now, you can read that all kinds of other ways too, but if you think about it in the high Anglican way of the Eucharist, the sin then is transformed in a bodily way, and the sister is restored. And so the end of the poem is this wonderful thing. And sometimes students read it, and I know we got to end, but the end is amazing because at the end you read it and you think, oh, such a conventional poem. They both end up married with little kids. But if you know Victorian literature, you know that's crazy because no one in Victorian literature, if you're a fallen woman, you never get to marry. Because no man in town wants you, and you certainly don't get to reproduce. And Rossetti says, no, there is no sin that cannot be redeemed. And the love of the sister and the love we need to have for our sisters and our brothers means we go out and face the goblins and we help bring our siblings back so they can experience the transforming power of God, which in the poem is actually pretty painful. Like, the sister goes through a whole thing. And so the end is the fallen sister testifying to her children about what her life was like. So it's not shameful, right? So a lot of times people who have experienced some sin, right, they don't want to talk about it, but they tell the little kids and they end with this little thing, there is no friend like a sister who comes around us in calm or stormy weather, right? And it's a call to both testimony, but also that no one is below the love of God. Even the Victorian, one of the most shocking things, the fallen woman, she can come back, she can be redeemed. And I love that. I think it's a beautifully hopeful poem. And it's written for a little, I mean, it's simple. Like the language is really, really simple. So in that way, she's the Auntie Hopkins. Very simple. It was published with like little kids in with poems for little kids. And yet I think it's a profound message. So please read Goblin Market. It's
Yes, there we
fantastic.
are. And Christina Rossetti, generally fascinating. Thank you, Jennifer. Jennifer is professor and chair of the English department at Calvin University in the States and co-director of the Calvin Center for Faith and Writing. Thank you, Jennifer, once again. And thanks to our creative team at Liquid Edge who sponsor this podcast and who take care of things behind the scenes. Jennifer, thank you so much for your time.
Brent, you're a scholar and a gentleman.
We really hope you've enjoyed this episode of the God Story Podcast. If you want to help us make more great episodes like this one, you can head over to our Patreon page and become a God Story Podcast supporter. You'll receive our undying gratitude, plus a few bonus goodies for your ongoing support. Just visit patreon.com/godstorypodcast. That's patreon.com/godstorypodcast. As always, you can get in touch with us via our website, godstorypodcast.com.